Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin with Dr. Paul Nelson here in the studio. Those who follow the ID the Future podcast know that we've had Dr. Nelson on the show for the last few podcasts, and he's been talking to us about common descent. We started at the very base of the tree of life, actually the origin of life. Then we moved up to the what's commonly called the root of the tree of life. We're going to be moving up the tree of life to talk about common descent at the level of the phylogeny of the various animal groups. And we're going to actually end with Paul's family history, and he's going to tell us about what his great-grandchildren will look like. But we're going to start right now with a couple papers today, Paul, which have interested me for some time now, because I think they're very candid about some of the conflicts that occur when you're looking at different phylogenies and whether we're getting a nice, neat picture of the tree of life, so to speak. And actually, I think both of these papers have two of the same co-authors, Antonis Rokas and Sean B. Carroll. And I hope I'm pronouncing Dr. Rokas' name correctly, but I think we should state up front, and you can maybe add to this or correct me if I'm wrong, that I mean both of these scientists are most certainly committed to the neo-Darwinian paradigm. You know, they have no support for intelligent design, so we're not at all trying to suggest that they are skeptics of neo-Darwinism. Would that be a fair thing to say?
I think so, and I think it's helpful to view what we're doing here today as describing to people what's going on within evolutionary theory itself and how evolutionary biologists are coming to grips with difficult questions in their own science.
That's right. Because, as we'll see, they do give answers for how they think that they can account for the data. We can discuss whether those are good answers, and I think a theme that's been going through this podcast is we have predictions being made by common descent. Those predictions are then falsified, and then what comes next? How do they deal with the data? Are they dealing with it well? And I think we've seen in some cases they are dealing with it sort of legitimately, perhaps with the lateral gene transfer hypothesis. In other cases, so far, it's difficult to say they're dealing with it well, especially when you're trying to account for how can you change the fundamental codon language of the genetic code without really destroying an organism's basic functions. So, and you're nodding in agreement for those who can't see this. So we're gonna look at some more ad hoc epicycles today and see if they're any good. And we have very much an expert here with us to help us sift through this. So the first paper I want to talk about is called Animal Evolution and the Molecular Signature of Radiations Compressed in Time. This is published in the journal Science, actually 3 days before the Dover decision came out, December 23rd, 2005. And this is by Antonis Rokas, Dirk Kruger, and Sean B. Carroll. And they actually say in this paper, I mean, it's been very common, you can again correct me if I'm wrong, that when phylogenies have conflicted with one another, you know, you have one gene predicting one phylogeny, another gene predicting another phylogeny, and I'll stop doing all the talking here soon. We didn't bring you out here so I could talk. You know, often the excuse has been when you have conflicting phylogenies is they will say, well, we just don't have enough data. We need to collect more data. And the more data that we collect, the better we'll be able to resolve the tree. And my personal view on this is that, you know, it's sort of, you're sort of trying to resolve, make two signals look similar by actually weakening the signal. The more data you collect, the weaker the signal becomes, but perhaps it will eventually, the two signals will begin to look alike. And so I think that's the way I look at this. But they actually say in this paper that despite the amount of data and breadth of taxa analyzed, relationships among most metazoan phyla remain unresolved. So what they're saying here, in my understanding, is that, you know, even though they've collected a lot of data, they still are seeing some conflicts between the basic metazoan phyla, which are the basic animal phyla. So I'm doing all the talking here, but what is your take on this conundrum that's facing some evolutionary biologists right now?
Well, to take a step back for a moment, one thing to keep in mind is that we don't actually know the history of life on Earth. That's not the impression.
Now, come now, Paul. Come
well, I know that's not the impression one would get from a museum exhibit or from diagrams and textbooks.
I saw it on PBS, actually. That's where I saw it. And Sean B. Carroll was on the Seattle Community Channel talking about evolution. So,
well, you know, it's a bit like going to a family reunion of your extended family. And, you know, you've got 100 people there. You're all enjoying the picnic. And it's time for the group photo. But no one knows where to stand. Do I stand with that group because they're my close kin, or do I stand over here with this other group? Who are my cousins, and so forth? Reconstructing the history of life is a very difficult problem. And there are, you know, different methods used, classically based on anatomical characteristics in conjunction with fossils. But really, in the 20th century, in the latter half of the 20th century, especially with the molecular revolution, most of the attempts to reconstruct the history of life on Earth are based on molecular data, DNA sequences. Now, the problem is one finds conflicts. As the paper you mentioned described, some genes will give one tree, other genes will give another tree. It's not clear how to sort them out. And in my own life, as a student of this issue, I've seen some remarkable groupings come into existence. For instance, there's a group now, a clade, a branching group, called the Ecdysozoa. That's a long name for organisms that molt. And in the Ecdysozoa, you have nematodes. These are very small worms. And you have fruit flies, both of which are molting creatures. Now, would you ever think, just sort of off the top of your head as a student of biology, to put together nematodes and fruit flies, or arthropods? Certainly this group did not exist when I was a student. It was created on the basis of molecular data.
Wow. So this is not just a morphological, you know, observation of, you know, some kind of convergent molting going on. This is actually at the molecular level.
This is talking about similarities. This is a group organized largely on the basis of molecular data. Now, what's striking about these groupings, going back in the history of evolutionary theory to Darwin's time, is they come and go. Groups are formed in this project of reconstructing the history of life. They have a kind of season of fashion when they're, if, as it were, in fashion, and then they go out of fashion. What's striking is from one decade to the next, there is a lot of instability in the groupings that one sees in evolutionary texts. And I think that that's a remarkable fact about this problem, that biology, historical biology, is not converging on the one true tree. Trees of relationships come and go with remarkable speed, and I think that's a striking fact about this problem.
Well, before we move on to the next paper, I want to read you a quote, and I want to get your reaction to this quote, because this was written in 1965. You're probably familiar with it. I know I didn't tell you I was going to read you this quote, so we'll just get your off-the-cuff response. This was actually written by Emil Zuckerkandl, who I believe is at Stanford now. Is that right?
Yes, and critiquing intelligent design there, in fact.
That's right. That's right. He's critiquing intelligent design in the journal Gene, I believe.
Yes.
Actually, and not just intelligent design, theism as well, if I recall the paper correctly. And he wrote back in 1965, so obviously this is a accomplished scientist who's been around for a long time. Earlier in his career, much earlier, he wrote, "It will be determined to what extent the phylogenetic tree, as derived from molecular data in complete independence from the result of organism biology, coincides with the phylogenetic tree constructed on the basis of organism biology. If the two phylogenetic trees are mostly in agreement with respect to the topology of branching, the best available single proof of the reality of macroevolution would be furnished. Indeed, only the theory of evolution, combined with the realization that events at any supermolecular level are consistent with molecular events, could reasonably account for such a congruence between lines of evidence obtained independently, namely amino acid sequences of homologous polypeptide chains on the one hand, and the finds of organism taxonomy and paleontology on the other." This is back in 1965, before they'd really started to understand genes, and he was making a prediction here. What the heck is he predicting, Paul?
Actually, that paper was published with Linus Pauling, a two-time Nobel laureate, and it's a classic paper in the history of this question, because the first sequences of proteins and genes were just being obtained at that time, mid-60s, and it didn't take long before people realized, well, from these gene and protein sequences, when we obtain them from different organisms, we ought to be able to build trees of evolutionary relationships, and compare those trees obtained from one kind of data, namely molecular, to the evolutionary trees of patterns of relationships that we obtained from classical anatomical and fossil data. The expectation was, from Zuckerkandl and Pauling and others at that time, that a phylogenetic or evolutionary tree obtained from molecular data ought to be congruent, that is, fit conformably with one that obtained from anatomical or other sources of data. And then one would have what's come to be known as twin nested hierarchies, confirming the prediction from Darwin's theory of common descent that all living things are related in one single tree. So I think it's a very powerful prediction. You've got an expectation from molecular evidence that there is a tree, and then you compare that tree to one that you had previously from more classical lines of evidence, and if the two fit conformably with each other, that would seem to be strong confirmation of Darwin's theory of common descent.
Okay, I'm going to read you another quote now, which I also did not tell you I was going to read, and I'm sure you're actually, I think you told me about this paper a few years ago, actually it was a number of years ago, and this is a paper that is sort of testing that prediction. Not, you know, they didn't, I don't know if they, I don't recall if they actually referenced that paper directly, but it was by Colin Patterson and some others, written in Annual Review of Ecology and Systematics back in 1993. And they write that, quote, "As morphologists with high hopes of molecular systematics, we end the survey with our hopes dampened. Congruence between molecular phylogenies is as elusive as it is in morphology and as it is between molecules and morphology." Again, what the heck is he saying here?
Well, what he's saying, and now this is a review paper published, gosh, would that be about 18 years later?
28 years.
28, I'm sorry, my math is awful. That the expectation that Zucker, Kandel, and Pauling had in 1965 turned out not to be supported. Colin Patterson and his co-authors of that paper were systematists at the British Museum in London, who looked at these large-scale patterns where one compares phylogenies based on anatomical data to those that come from molecular data. And often, those phylogenies were in conflict. If I can go back to my family reunion metaphor, you've got the cousins and the uncles and the aunts squabbling about where people should stand in the family picture. Is the clade Ecdysozoa real or not? There, right now, in April 2007, there's an ongoing debate about whether this new group that puts together nematodes and arthropods and other organisms that molt, whether that group is real, is something very much being debated at the moment. So the quote that you read says, you know, there's a general pattern here of conflict among these different kinds of trees. Now, here's a problem. I don't know that anyone has done the kind of meta-analysis that I would like to see, where one looks through the past 2-3 decades worth of molecular evolutionary studies and systematics work using anatomical characters to see overall, in terms of all the phylogenies that have been generated, are they in conflict or not? What's the overall signal? I don't know that anyone has done that, and I think people have various impressions from that. Certainly, my own experience as a student of this problem has been that there is great instability in many of the larger scale evolutionary trees that are generated. And I think that's troubling. It seems to me that if there was, as Darwin postulated, a single true tree of life, that over the course of work in systematics and comparative anatomy, comparative morphology, and now in molecular studies, that scientists ought to be converging to that tree. Mm. In other words, it was really out there as a historical pattern. Mm-hmm. You ought to be reconstructing it. And in fact, I see things going in very much the different direction.
Well, Paul, I think that there's a lot more to talk about here, but unfortunately we're running short on time. So we're going to have to save this for another podcast, where we will finish actually talking about the papers that we wanted to talk about by Antonis Rokas and Sean B. Carroll. So how does that sound? We'll continue this on in future podcasts. Okay. So thank you for listening. Stay tuned for future podcasts, where we will talk about more with Common Descent with Dr. Paul Nelson. This is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast signing off.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.